U.S. culinary writers are on edge today after the publication of Martha Stewart's recipe for grilled monkfish in the latest issue of her magazine, a recipe many see as a clear message to her enemies. Los Angeles Times food critic Dana Holloway says the under 30 minutes recipe shouldn't be taken lightly.
When you put a recipe like that together with so many hazelnuts, the message is clear. Do not fuck with me.
Many believe that Stewart's elegant recipe for spiced apple crepes led to the untimely death of rap singer Tupac Shakur. Doyle Redland for The Onion Radio News.
Happy Valentine's Day, everybody. Welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. My name is Phil, and today we're discussing many things about food culture and the world of food. Right up front, I wanted to apologize to anybody who may have heard me slurring my ass off in the last show. Good Lord. I heard it back and I thought to myself, what the hell am I doing? And I made a promise that I would never do a drunk show. And, well, there it is. So, to make up for it, this will be an alcohol-free show. No beer, nothing. All right, but it was great to have Don here in the studio, to finally have him on the show, and I hope we can get him back in soon. It's always great to have him here. Some interesting things going on. I've got a lot of new listeners who have recently started listening to the program and who have emailed me and commented. I wanted to welcome in particular Matt in Seattle from Facebook and Andrew from Palette Food and Wine, who has a website, ChristianEpicurean.com. where he explores his relationship between food and theology. And that's an interesting story in and of itself, because as it turns out, here's how I found out about Andrew. My cousin is friends with him, has been friends with him for a while, and they talked or something, and she sent me an email. She goes, oh, I'd like to introduce you to my friend Andrew. I said, oh, okay. She goes, oh, he knows about your show. And I said, all right. And then she said, oh, he's got this website, Christian Epicurean. So I go to it. Yes, you know, he's religious. And this show is not religious. I curse a lot on this show. And I just thought, well, I hope he's not like offended or anything. So she tells me he's in culinary school. He's going to culinary school in Pasadena. Sends me his website. So I go and I'm looking at the website. And I'm seeing these pictures. And Palette Food and Wine right off the bat, just kind of like, I've heard of that before. As it turns out, the pictures that I saw on the website were from Joe. From My Last Bite. She shot them because she had done a post on this restaurant. It was in a mall in Los Angeles. And the only reason why I even remembered these pictures was because there's a cheese station and that's where Andrew works. And that was him. There are pictures of him at the cheese station. And I thought, how cool that a restaurant has a cheese station. And there's salumi hanging everywhere, you know, cured meats. So, of course, I'm reading his blog, and he says, you know, thanks to Joe at My Last Bite for the pictures. And I thought, oh my God, small world. Welcome to Andrew as well. Palette Food and Wine. Sounds like a great place, too. Anyway, Valentine's Day is right around the corner. And I've always said that Valentine's Day is for rookies. I mean, going out to dinner on Valentine's Day, it's kind of, you know, for people who are still dating or in the early years of the relationship. You know, if you go out on Valentine's Day, the restaurants are booked. It's crowded everywhere you go. The guys are just doing the best they can for you know what. You know, it's not all that romantic, if you ask me. But it does bring to a point that I make about food a lot. And not just around the Hallmark holidays like Valentine's Day. There is a definite connection between love and food. I mean, there are certain foods that give you the same feeling as being in love or falling in love. And the most common of these is chocolate. And that could be the reason why chocolate has kind of been the symbol of Valentine's Day for so many people. You give her chocolate, and when she eats it, she'll get the sensation of being in love, and then she'll think of you because you gave the chocolate to her. You know? Well, think about that for a second. Let that soak in just a little bit, right? Because what happens when the chocolate runs out? Where the hell are you then? You know, you best polish that personality. Because the chocolate's not going to be around forever. But I've always said that I can taste the love in some food. You know, food has soul. Good food has soul, not all food. I mean, there's no love in a Big Mac. But there's love in my friend Jill's velvet cupcakes. There's love in her beef bourguignon that she serves over cheesy polenta. There's a ton of love in that. You can taste it. Every bite has a little bit of love in it. My friend Martha makes soup. It's just awesome soup. And it's like you can taste the love in that soup. So there is a connection, and if you're in tune with it, you'll feel it. I mean, some food goes right to the soul. You know, it says, you know, this is for you. And you feel that. I mean, some people cry when they eat at Alinea because of the emotional connection that he makes with them with the food there. So, you know, you can't say there's no love in food because there is. You just have to think of it that way. But people often mistake sex for love. I mean, Anthony Bourdain and Mario Batali had this conversation in their segment Chewing the Fat on SiriusEats.com last month. And it really made me think about the connections between love and food. Listen.
I believe in food and sex. I believe in food then sex. But, you know, food and sex together, I'm always deeply disturbed by people who talk about, you know, they get a little too excited talking about chocolate. They're just wrong. I mean, you know, I don't see anything erotic about, like, you know, bringing food to bed. You know, there's a whole new meaning of rolling over into the wet spot.
Do you like rolling onto the wet spot?
No.
Oh, okay.
Good. Well, reminds me of camp in a bad way.
Right. Yay. There's a couple of ways in life that you make someone happy by putting them, something inside of them.
Yeah.
And that's food, and that's sex.
Right.
There's ways that food works into sex because you make someone a great meal, and you can arouse them and later on have sex with them.
So there's a point in there. Batali says there's a connection between food and sex. Because you make them this great meal, and they feel loved by you, which then sometimes lead to sex. And you know what? There's there's one reason to get good in the kitchen. Because that leads to activities in other rooms of the house. But do we do this because we love them? I mean, I know I do. I know a lot of people think this way. Feeding people, at least in my house, in a lot of Italian-American homes, in a lot of homes, is a way to tell people that you love them. It's one way to express that. By warming them inside with something delicious and filling, you're bringing them joy. You're making them feel comforted and loved. One of my wife's best friends stopped by one night for like 10 minutes, and I knew she was coming. And I was making this pot of stew, and I offered her something to eat. She says, you know, you don't have to feed me every time I come here. And I said, yeah, I do. You know, you don't have to eat, but I have to offer. I mean, I feel obligated to feed every person who walks through my door. In my house, that's how I was raised, that's how it is, and that's how it's going to be. I always want my house to be a warming experience, and the best way I can translate that is with food. It's the least common denominator for me. It's how I can speak to you. So, there should never be any time when someone doesn't feel warmth and love in my house, and food is the best vehicle that I have for that.
As a prelude to
using eggplant for sex is not nearly as exciting as it seems to be cracked up. Well,
and let's face it, 15, you know, a meal at the French Laundry or per se followed by sex would be a, you know, there would be an audio component. You know, it would be a gassy and painful and generally unpleasant experience if possible at all. I need a nap after a long nap.
Well, how about like after a Japanese meal, though?
Ah, no, see, that's perfect. See, also, there's a lot of weeding, and there's a weeding out process, too. You know, any important relationship in my life began with a meal at a good sushi restaurant. You know, if it's like, oh, no, I don't, no uni, no, I don't do, it's pretty much that relationship.
Salmon skin rolls.
That relationship's over from the beginning. If they don't like uni, and if they're too picky about a sushi meal, there's really no possibility of
good
sex.
There will be no sex.
Or it will be subpar. In anticipation of a great meal, you do physiologically go through exactly the same changes, engorgement of various membranes, as you do prior to sex. But I think it's like church and state. There should be some
separation.
There should be some separation, yeah.
I have two blog posts that are planned soon that'll lead into spring and picnics. So if you want to do something really romantic this spring, it doesn't have to be on Valentine's Day. Prepare some things, some finger foods, things that can be eaten with your hands, some decadent things, maybe some not-so-decadent things. Pack them in your cooler bag with a bottle of wine or some bottled water and just take off somewhere. You know, go for a hike in the mountains or a big field or anywhere where you have some space alone. Bring this along, lay a big blanket under a tree or something, and just sit and eat and talk and enjoy each other's company. I mean, it's honestly one of the most romantic things you can do, and you'll both remember it. So stay tuned for that. I've got a couple things in line. And be forewarned, there is chicken liver pate in your future. And I just don't know that there's anything more decadent than that. Now, I want to talk about something here that leads back to a conversation that I had with Don on the last show. And he brought up an interesting point, one that I thought about, and I thought it was worth digging in just a little bit deeper. Now, Michael Ruhlman posted on his blog last week about germs and how we're all caught up in this whole hysteria of germs. And with all due respect to Ruhlman, I'm going to paraphrase here to keep it short, but, you know, I'm kind of like copying from him here. All right, from his blog, and I'm just going to chop this up. Yet another facet of America's many neuroses about food, health, and our bodies is a fear of germs and a complete misunderstanding of bacteria and good and bad microbes. The shelves are filled with antibacterial soaps. This fear is certainly not keeping us from getting sick, and it's very likely increasing the probability that we will. When I was growing up, I never heard of a kid who couldn't eat peanut butter. Now I have close friends whose two boys are seriously allergic to so many foods, cooking a single dinner for all of them is nearly impossible. This is not another America is a bunch of picky eaters rant. The kids' allergies are real. But when did they begin and why? My guess is that they began around the time their parents began to consume vast quantities of industrial processed foods, sterile food, food that can sit on a shelf for a lifetime, food that is not even biodegradable. And Ruhlman brings up a really great point. He asks if anybody watched the extras on the Super Size Me DVD. And I'm not sure if any of you have seen it or have seen the extras. But he does this experiment where he takes these three glass jars. He put a Big Mac in one of them, a Filet-O-Fish sandwich in another one, and an order of fries. And then he would go and check it. Like once a month, he'd go and check it. And, you know, the Big Mac would be growing a little furry and the Filet-O-Fish not as furry. And the fries... In the entire experiment, I think it lasted 6 months, never grew mold, did not break down ever. That's how much is in those things. That's how many preservatives are in those fries. Anyway, back to Ruhlman. In order to keep foods on the shelf indefinitely requires getting rid of bacteria that causes spoilage. But in keeping our food ultra-sterile, we may be killing microbes that help to keep us healthy and fit. Yet another reason to eat unprocessed foods. Natural foods, a lot of fruits and vegetables. Wash them, of course, but don't sterilize them. We aren't getting more healthy by eating processed food. We're getting more sick. And he's right. Ruhlman is absolutely right. And it brings me to the most important point that I can drill home on this show. And it's a point I've been bringing up time and time and time again, and I'll talk about it till I'm blue in the face. Buy the freshest food you can, untreated. Don't cook the hell out of it. Make it a daily habit. And we won't be sick, we'll just get stronger, and our kids will be stronger. We'll live long, healthy, happy lives, and we'll get back on track. You know, Joe at My Last Bite reviewed that local sushi restaurant recently, and her pictures were just beautiful. I mean, they encompassed everything I love about Japanese food. The fish was raw, nothing special, very simple. Sliced thin over long, thin slices of fresh cucumber, it just looked beautiful. Like I said, almost too beautiful to eat. And I wondered, what is it that attracts us to that food? And I thought, I know what it is. It's because it's fresh. It's because it is fresh food. That's very simple, fresh food. It hasn't been tormented by sauces, preservatives. It's not burnt to a crisp. It's not deep fried in batter, stuffed into a wheat roll, covered in mayonnaise or cheese or whatever. It's in its freshest, purest form. It tastes better that way. And we're going to be healthier for eating it just like that. And then I thought, well, you know, that sushi is definitely a metaphor for how should we eat all of our food. It's fine just how it is. Nature made it this way. That's how you should eat it. Pick it, clean it, cook it a little bit, season it a little bit, serve it immediately. And that's all I have to say. Just quit eating all that canned shit, all that box stuff in the inside aisles. It's going to kill us all from the inside out. Do it for your kids. And don't give me any of the bullshit about how our parents ate canned and processed food when they were pregnant with us. And we were fine. We're fine now. They smoked and they drank while they were pregnant with us. And we're fine. And believe me, this is something that takes a long time to absorb itself into our systems. The chemicals involved now are a lot more advanced and far and away from being natural than they were back in the 50s and 60s. I mean, it started then, but it's a lot worse now. You know, they didn't know the effect of cigarettes in the 30s and 40s, so it was still cool then. But then movie stars start keeling off from lung, tongue, and throat cancer, and word got out. I mean, it's not so cool anymore now, is it, Bogart? So spare me the bullshit about how strong our parents were, or how strong we are. We're dying from the inside out from chemistry in our food, so cut it out. Unless you want to die, you know? Then, you know, more power to you, knock yourself out. Now, this is all going to be old news now, but I need to share it anyway. It broke the day after I recorded the last show with Don, and it would have just been perfect to talk about with him, but I'm just not going to let this one die because it's really hot and it's great content for the show. Anyway, in his ever-expanding quest to completely ostracize almost everybody related to food, Bourdain has now a new target, Alice Waters. I'm going to tell you something. I'm with him on this for one thing, because he makes a good point about it. And before I start getting hate mail, or you turn me off, hang on, just listen. I respect Waters a lot. Her cookbook sits on my rack. I cook from it. I live by her philosophy of eating simple food, fresh food, lots of green food. Don't cook the hell out of it, you know? I got it. I love it. I live by that. But Bourdain himself says that he even cooks organic food and serves it to his family, but that he thinks that Waters' philosophy is kind of unrealistic right now when you consider the state of the economy and the fact that people are pinching pennies. So he did an interview with this website magazine. He was promoting his Washington, D.C. show, No Reservations in Washington. And I'm going to quote from the article. Bourdain said, "Alice Waters annoys the living shit out of me. We're all in the middle of a recession. Like we're all going to go start buying expensive organic food and running to the green market. There's something very Khmer Rouge about Alice Waters that has become unrealistic. I mean, I'm not crazy about our obsession with corn or ethanol and all that, but I'm a little uncomfortable with legislating good eating habits. I'm suspicious of orthodoxy, the kind of orthodoxy when it comes to what you put in your mouth. I'm a little reluctant to admit that maybe Americans are too stupid to figure out that the food we're eating is killing us. But I don't know if it's time to send out special squads to close all the McDonald's. My libertarian side is at odds with my revulsion at what we as a country have done to ourselves physically with what we've chosen to eat in our fast food culture. I'm really divided on that issue." Then he backtracked after that. He said, "I respect Alice Waters' enormous contribution to changing the way we eat and cook today. No one can take that away from her. No one should try." Now, I struggle with this, and I have struggled with this for the better part of a year now. On this show, I have done all that I can to encourage you to buy fresh, pesticide-free food, U.S.-grown, farm-raised poultry, beef, pork, chicken, everything. You know, maybe spend a little bit extra to get the good stuff when you can get it, because, you know, I think that you're worth it. If you feel that you're worth it, you should do it. But given the fact that we're faced with a recession, unemployment at an all-time high, everyone slowly sliding into the economic abyss, you know, it's kind of hard for me to stand here and do that continually. You know, if it's too hard for you to spend an extra $3 a pound for local farm-raised beef, who the hell am I to say anything about it? I mean, my goal is only to open anyone's eyes who doesn't realize that it's not really that hard to eat a little bit better. And for an extra $1 to a meal, and in a lot of cases, even cheaper than what you're already spending. Fresher, cheaper. But the whole organic craze that Waters is standing behind here is just kind of stupid. I never bought into it. I refuse to buy into it. It's just not necessary. It takes 4 years for these farms to become certified organic. It's expensive, really expensive for farms to do this. I'm going to tell you a secret. A lot of these farmers at the farmers market aren't using chemicals. Some might, but a lot do not. Ask them. Next time you're down there, ask them if they spray their crops. They're more than willing to tell you. And if they do, you know what they're spraying them with? You'd be surprised. Some of the farmers I buy from, they spray with soap and water and that's it. Some others spray with this garlic-based spray. Everyone has their own homebrew recipes. One guy I spoke to used a cocktail he makes with hot peppers and horseradish. I said, does that kill the bugs? He goes, no, it gets them to piss off. It does a damn good job of keeping these pains in the ass off your plants. Let me think. If you're a bug and you're, you know, chomping down on a tomato, and then I spray you down with hot pepper and horseradish sauce, are you not going to move your ass? You know, I know I would. But this whole fad of eating organic, it's something new for the rich and affluent. I mean, they went from Starbucks and their skimmed chai, frappuccino, half-calf, half-decaf, whatever the hell that goofy shit is that they drink. Now it's about the O word, and not the one they really should be obsessing over. Yeah, I think these people are just kind of sick. I mean, I see them at Whole Foods sometimes, and in the checkout lane, they're just beaming with pride. They wear it like a badge of honor. Look at me and my expensive organic produce. And I'm like, yeah, look at you. Okay, I have some audio for you here from CNN. It's not about China. I'm sure you guys are really shocked. Burger King CEO John Chidsey was being interviewed by CNN, and they asked him why Burger King is looking to the future with confidence because of the down economy.
Why is your sector doing so well?
Well, I think it's, as you said, Charles, people have to eat first and foremost, and I think second of all, you know, we're at the value end of the chain. So I think players like McDonald's, like ourselves, maybe people who are strapped for cash, move down from the Applebee's, the Chili's, the TGI Fridays, places like that, and McDonald's, Burger King, other quick service restaurants really provide value.
Do you think it'll stay that way, or do you think that's just a feature of, if you like, being at the start of the crisis that we're in right now?
No, I think actually it will stay that way. I believe that, you know, a lot of these people have come back to the space that maybe haven't been there in 5 or 6 years, and I think the whole industry's really dramatically improved the quality of their products and certainly the breadth of their offerings, and so I think we'll capture a fair number of those in the long run.
Now, you talk about the quality of your products, and you as an industry have been under some attack, essentially saying that you're purveying unhealthy foods and that children are being encouraged through your very strong branding to think that this is good when actually it's something that they should eat only sparingly. How have you responded?
Well, I think in two ways. First and foremost, in the UK and in most of Europe and in the US as well, we don't advertise to children under 12. But more importantly than that, our brand promises have it your way, where all your sandwiches can be made to order. And we certainly have items on the menu, whether it's salads, whether it's veggie burgers, whether it's grilled chicken sandwiches, whether it's apple fries, where we actually have real apples sent through a press so they come out looking like a French fry for children. So we have all sorts of healthy items on our menu so that you really have a little bit for everybody.
Oh, yeah, you don't market to kids. Bullshit. There's only free toys with every meal. Your mascot's a cartoon-looking king. Apple fries. This is what I don't get about people like this, dude. How can they defend their food as being healthy? They're offering a healthy alternative? Everything they sell is loaded with preservatives. High fructose corn syrup, you name it. I mean, please don't tell me you fry those apple fries. I mean, how fresh are the apples, too? You know you're not shopping for apples every day. They're frozen, probably. Just like regular fries. Months old. Probably have preservatives in them to keep them fresh. Mmm, nutritious.
Let's get back to the big picture now here, John. The global recession. Overnight, the House approved the $820 billion package that the Obama administration is putting into effect. Are you happy about that? Do you feel that these kind of fiscal stimulus packages are what you in industry need?
Well, I'm not sure anybody is exactly certain or for sure that's exactly what the doctor ordered. But I believe the stimulus, yes, will help. And as I said, you know, we're somewhat recession immune. So from our perspective, I'm not sure we're going to see a huge difference.
But a few dollars in people's pockets are not going to hurt you, are they?
And I believe for the industry overall, or the economy overall, it will be a net positive.
Well, I don't think you have a lot to worry about. You know, it will be a net positive. There's no question about that. People who have broken the addiction of your convenient, delicious food, you know, that also encourages heart disease and obesity, but we won't mention that, right? Yeah, they're drawn to it now because they can't eat in more expensive places because they can't afford it. So, you know, even when things get better, they're still going to stick around because they're addicted to your stuff, like cigarettes. Man, am I bitchy today? Oh, I'm really bitchy today. Oh, where's the value? this other thing, the New York Times Magazine ran a really cool article last weekend titled Aging Gracefully. Not sure if you guys saw this. It's about Herb Eckhouse. Herb Eckhouse has a salumi house, Liquorcia. They make prosciutto in Iowa, of all places. Liquorcia makes prosciutto here in the U.S. It rivals the prosciutto from Parma. Seriously, they say it's that good. But he is pretty cool. He embraced European ideals to make his prosciutto, and you know, it shows. But the best thing about the article was some of the things that Herb said. He said, it was clear that we had this incredible bounty around us, but we weren't known for creating great stuff to eat. And I thought about that, you know, 2 years ago, early on in the podcast, this podcast, I did a show called Food Hell. I'd gone to the Midwest, Nebraska, and I was hoping to come back with some really great food stories because I kind of thought Nebraska being like right in the center of the United States, it was kind of like, you know, a big mecca of food. This is where we grew. It's the heartland of America. Lots of farms, lots of farming. What I came back with was a bit of enlightenment that we're really not growing a damn thing out there but corn that we really can't even eat. You know, produce high fructose corn syrup that sweetens our food, ethanol. It really, that's it. That's what we're producing. High fructose corn syrup to put into food that doesn't have any flavor to make it more palatable for people who, you know, don't really have zest for food or life. So for this guy to actually acknowledge that was kind of huge. You know, you have all this great land around you and you're doing nothing. Nothing natural, nothing good with it. Just a big waste. He also said, in the beginning of the 20th century, Iowa fed people. And here we are in the 21st century, and we're feeding machines. It's just wrong. Again, with the corn. Our great bounty is something that we can't even eat. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, do yourself a favor. Do a little My Life as a Foodie homework. Go back in the blog and look for an episode called Food Hell, and then go from there. And then watch this documentary, King Corn. It explains everything. If you don't know much about, you know what's going on with corn. But it opened my eyes right on the show, and it kind of just changed the direction I was headed with this. But later in the article, Herb said, one of the things in the U.S. is that we don't have the thousands of years of experience and tradition of making prosciutto or of making anything. Now, I thought about this. We don't have thousands of years of tradition of making anything, really, because we're too young. We haven't been around that long. But the one thing we have made the longest that we're still being, you know, produced here is beer. And of all the beer that we've made the longest, it's Budweiser. Now, you really want to stand behind a product like that? And maybe the fact that we don't have thousands of years of tradition of making anything is why we don't respect the food that we do produce. This is why we're kicking it around. The other thing he said was that you see the quality of the meat comes from the quality of the life of the animal and the quality of the feed. And right there I said, you know, if he hadn't said any of the other stuff, he hit the nail right firmly on the head. Respect the animal, treat it right, feed it right, and we'll all taste the quality of the meat. I mean, you want to argue with me about how stupid it is to defend the treatment of the animal before we kill it because we're still killing it? You know, it's about quality. Yes, it's the animal's here to feed me. I know that. Yes, it's going to give its life for me. I know that too. There's no reason I shouldn't respect the animal in the entire process. The animal deserves it, and why would I want to disrespect my food? Look at the end result of that cheap slop that you shovel in your mouth from McDonald's. If you think that that's what you're worth, then help yourself. But my body's worth a little bit more than that. And if yours isn't, that's fine. That's your problem. Knock yourself out, kid. You know, I don't care. I got that argument not too long ago. Boy, you sure do like to sit on your high horse. Not sit on my high horse. That's just how I think. You like to hurt animals? Please. And you know what we haven't talked about in a while? Top Chef. I have to say something. I've been a fan of this show for a long time. And I thought season one was the best of the bunch. This season just gets better and better and better and better. I mean, it's down to five chefs right now, going into this week. And it's really getting interesting. My pick was Jamie, and she got kicked off last week, so she's out. Bravo replays Top Chef all the time. New shows on Wednesdays at 7, And the remaining chefs are Carla, Leah, Stefan, Hosea, and Fabio. And of that bunch now, probably going to be Hosea and Stefan making it to the final. I just don't see Leah hanging out for much longer. She might go this week, then Fabio, then Carla. And Fabio's funny, charming guy, Italian, but I just don't see him as the strongest chef in the group. I did it early on. I was kind of, you know, impressed with him, but he hasn't won anything. He hasn't won a single challenge. He argues with the judges all the time. And his charm is going to wear off eventually, if it hasn't already. But they're really good chefs this season, too. They're nowhere near as good as the top-tier chefs from last season. Even season three had some really serious, seriously good talent. Then they just can't compete with that. But I think it's head and shoulders above anything Food Network has in their lineup. But there are lots of storylines this season. Hosea and Leah have this whole romantic thing going on. And they, you know, hang out together, and they were laying on a bed, and they got busted by the camera. They were lying down, and they were kissing each other. And they're like, they both have, like, boyfriend and girlfriend back home. So there's all this sexual tension in the air. That's great. And then Stefan is, like, this arrogant male chauvinist. He's trying to get into Jamie's pants, and Jamie's gay. You know, she's just short of hanging a sign around her neck. It says, you know, piss off, I'm a lesbian. I like chicks. Ugh, what a dynamic. Bourdain's not there, and you can kind of feel it, but I don't think he wanted to do it anyway. And I don't think he'd have opened his mouth like he did if he wanted to hang around. But I noticed that this year that there was nowhere near the amount of bleeping that last year had. They just don't curse as much. And I didn't notice it at first, but it's refreshing. So a couple weeks ago, they were forced to compete against selected chefs from previous seasons. And they had Spike and Andrew from last year, two of the guys that cussed the most. So we were treated to a nice clip like this.
Dear Season 5, if you don't bring your A game, you're going to get f***ing stomped, and I will be peeing on your bodies.
I haven't gotten a chance to talk about Season 6 of No Reservations yet, either. I'm not sure why I haven't, really. I mean, it's 6 episodes in now. I think I just don't care a lot about it, because they're just not going into places I, you know, I'm really interested in. Like I said, I thought it was starting to jump the shark last year. What I've seen so far this year is just not changing my mind a whole lot. Of the 6 episodes I've seen so far, only Washington, D.C. has been worth watching. And that's only because of Jose Andres, who I like. The more I watch him, the more I like him. And, you know, the other thing is that Bourdain was this snark. The guy that we fell in love with was the snarky dude from Cook's Tour, the skinny Bourdain. Dressed a little nicer, wore stylish sunglasses, not these big fat Ray-Bans that he wears now. He acted like a chef from Les Halles, not a member of the Hell's Angels, with the tattoos and the black shirt and jeans. I don't know. It's just his persona is just not doing it for me. You want to, you know, guys want to look like another guy. Want to, like, you know, get some personality trait from him and bring that into their life. And there's not a whole lot about him right now I want to be like. I mean, listen, I still like the guy. Still watch his show. I'll continue to read his books and watch everything he's doing. But that edge that made him famous, I think he's kind of lost it a little bit. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I'm not as inspired by him as I was before. But I'm grateful for everything, including the Les Halles cookbook that is one of the most widely used books on my shelf, stained with duck fat. Earmarked, scribbles all over the place. Awesome book. The other thing about Bourdain is that he wears his libertarianism on his sleeve a little bit too much. And I think that irritates me a lot. Not that I don't have some of that in me too, but I don't wear it on my sleeve. I don't tell people, oh, by the way, I'm a libertarian. You know, I don't need to know that. By the way, I'm a Christian. I don't need to know that. You can hold that stuff in. You can have those values. Practice them. But I don't need to know that all the time. All I know is that what I said before, if he just did shows from Asia, all around Asia, and then France every once in a while, visit Spain, high-end U.S. restaurants like the French Laundry, Alinea, maybe go to a Fat Duck in Britain, and just do those in a loop, I wouldn't have a problem. I think a lot of people wouldn't have a problem either. He's just going to some places that just don't appeal to me too much. He's supposed to be visiting Vietnam again this year, so I'm looking forward to that. As far as I'm concerned, he can't go there enough.
Jose is big daddy of the DC fine dining scene with 7, count them 7, restaurants. I'm here to try his most creative and experimental, his tiny, pocket-sized restaurant within a restaurant, mini bar. Six very special seats in a very special bar tucked away inside Cafe Atlantico.
At Minibar, we do what people in a wrong way, they call it molecular gastronomy, which I don't call it that way.
Who admits to doing molecular gastronomy? Because I don't know anyone who says I do it, other than people who do it really badly.
All right, so listen, while I'm on the subject of Jose Andres, because I really did love that episode of No Reservations, he went to Jose's restaurant, and then they went into his mini bar, where they do little tiny tapas and molecular gastronomy. This guy cracks me up. Jose is an awesome chef. He's a great personality, and his Spanish tapas cookbook has gotten so much use on my cookbook shelf. And this guy, he has a show Made in Spain. It's on PBS. He has such reverence and appreciation for food, he can expound upon something as simple as a potato and tell you all the little nuances about it and how beautiful it is. And if anything really kind of encapsulates what I love about food, it's people like Jose who are so passionate about it that they can take little simple things, pluck them from the ground, find beauty in it that makes me want to eat one right now. And I didn't even know that he had the show Made in Spain before Joe at My Last Bite had told me about it. So I looked on my TiVo, there it is, and now I'm watching it all the time. I have a season pass. But he makes me laugh. Here's the thing. He's a great chef, but he makes me laugh. His Spanglish is second to none. And the more I listen to him, the more I realize he was reminding me of somebody. I want you to listen to this. I'm going to do a little audio thing here. This is Jose Andres on his show, Made in Spain.
So we get a bit of the fish, little bit of the sweet potatoes, the soft, beautiful potatoes that already absorb so much of the flavors.
All right, now listen to this. This is the innkeeper from 1931's Dracula warning Renfield from entering the forest when the sun goes down because of the vampires.
Dracula and his wives, they take the form of wolves and bats. They leave their coffins at night, and they feed on the blood of the living.
Come on, man. He sounds just like that dude. Love that. I'm a horror movie whore, all right? So it really makes me laugh. Every time he comes on, this is what I hear. I hear this dude. He, well, no matter what he says.
Little bit of the sweet potatoes.
You know, I he sounds like this dude.
They leave their coffins at night.
Jose loves food so much that he finds it necessary to whisper when things get delicate.
They absorb so much of the flavors.
I hope I didn't piss anyone off with that. I just thought it was funny. I think every time I see his show, I think of that. And believe me, his English is far better than my Spanish, all right? My Spanish sucks, and I know it. I can't manage to speak Spanish without sounding like Cheech from Cheech and Chong. If I'm in a Spanish or a Mexican restaurant, I have to order like directly off the menu. So if I try to wing it, I'm in so much trouble. Like, deme un zapato con queso en él. You know? And I just ordered like a shoe with cheese on it. And the waiter's like, you sure that's what you want, senor? I'm like, yes, extra cheese. Anyway, Made in Spain with Jose Andres. Great cooking show. If you're into Spanish cuisine or cooking European in any way, this is just a great show. It's just a good show for foodies. It's on PBS station, so check your local listings. Made in Spain. All right, listen, you know, it's been real, but I got to hit the road. I want to thank you all for listening yet again. Thanks to all of the new listeners and members of the My Life as a Foodie Facebook group. Love that. I appreciate your comments and your feedback, as always. Music in this episode from Christoph Goes. If you like the song, download it in the iTunes store. Just click on the link on our website, mylifeasafoodie.com, and order it. 99 cents. Support the arts. Real cheap. Have a great Valentine's Day, everybody. Be good to each other. And until next time, my name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie. Ciao, bella. Jealousy.